All right, so, Book of Amos, and you know that we have covered so far chapter 1 and dealing with all the nations around Israel. By now you know that the primary premise of the book has to do with oracles or judgments against Israel. And so last week we got finished with the nations and we dealt with Judah a little bit. So it's getting a little closer to home for the Israelites. And we made mention of the fact that when we get to Judah, you see a definite change in the nature of the oracle. That, remember, each nation, there was one crime, spiritual crime, one transgression, one sin that is pointed out by Amos that they'll be punished for. But it was always a sin against humanity, some kind of act of unrighteousness or something along those natures. But last week we saw with Judah, it changed. God is condemning them because they rejected the law of the Lord and have not kept his statutes. And so they were a covenant people with God. And that's why now it has changed. They have violated the covenant. They have broken the law. And the way that it's stated here is what really makes it applicable to us today. We're God's covenant people now. And we have to make sure that we don't reject the law of the Lord. Our case is the gospel of Christ. And we reject that word the same way that they did. They have not kept his statutes. And so when that's the bottom line. If you're not obeying the gospel, not just the original steps of hearing, believing, repenting, confessing, and being baptized, but if you're not walking in the Word, being led by the Spirit, willing to keep all the commandments of God, then you have rejected the law of the Lord. And so we need to take that very seriously because, again, as I said, we are the covenant people today. Remember, we're now the royal priesthood, the holy nation. It used to be Israel, but they lost that right because they wouldn't obey. And so, that down, maybe that'll help. And so now that has been transferred to us. 1 Timothy 2 at verse 9 makes that clear. And so we can certainly learn from them. We don't want to follow their bad example. Well, now we're finally ready to get to Israel, which again is the primary point of the book. And if you've been paying attention, Amos is kind of, it's like he's put a noose around the neck of Israel and he's just tightening it a little bit at a time. And he did that. That's why he introduced the nations really in the first place. If you look, you've seen that we've had the map up on the screen, for several weeks, but you see where they're located. And the first three nations that he dealt with, beginning, and of course it was Damascus, but we emphasize that Damascus represents Syria. He talks about Gaza and Tyre, but they represent their respective nations, Philistines and those from Phoenicia. And so those are the three nations. What's their connection to Israel? There isn't one really, except for politically. That's the only connection that they have. So that wouldn't really cause the Israelites to give much thought to these judgments, these oracles against them. In fact, they would be happy to hear that judgment was going to come upon them because they only had just a political relationship to them. And of course, much of the time, it wasn't good. But then the next three nations, Ammon and Moab and Edom, now they're cousins. So the noose is getting a little tighter, getting a little more uncomfortable. Amos is getting a little closer to home because of their past connection. And then last week, as we saw, now you get to Judah. And now you're talking about brethren. So it goes from nations that no affiliation at all except politically, then to cousins who have a past and a part of the same lineage, not direct, but a part, again, cousins to Judah. And now they have to be thinking, he's getting pretty close. And then finally, we get to where we are now, and he hits them directly. And so tonight, then, we want to look at the oracles against Israel. And there's several sins. First of all, the sinful acts of Israel. And what we find is that there are four things that are emphasized with regard to Israel. Now, that doesn't mean that's the only problems that they had. It'll be enlarged as we go on. But in this passage, in this context, Amos identifies four sins against them. And it's really remarkable how far the people of God can fall. And again, that's where we can make some practical application. Remember, why in the world study the minor prophets? They're books dealing, remember the original Hebrew was just one book, but it's dealing with a specific people at a specific time and condemning them for specific reasons. What in the world does it have to do with us? Well, it's the practical applications we can get from it, because we can violate the covenant with God in some of the same ways that they did. We can be guilty of some of the same sins, and we are as a whole. I'm not talking about us individually, but you know, individually we can be, and we know that individual Christians have been guilty of some of the same things that they were guilty of. And so these, and it's true even with these four things that Amos points out. Interestingly enough, the first one is the sin of injustice. And that's interesting because that's the very sin that God condemned some of the nations for. And that's kind of a shameful thing. Now, remember what we said back with the nations, that Amos was only dealing with one sin with each nation. But that doesn't mean that they weren't guilty of a whole lot of other sins. Of course, they were. And now when we get to the covenant people, their primary sin was a violation of the covenant. But that doesn't mean that they're not guilty of some of the things that the nations were guilty of. And they are. And we see that in this very first point. Their first problem of Israel was injustice. And it was particularly grievous because it was against brethren. And remember, we saw with the nations that meant something. With Edom, God charged her for pursuing your brother. And that was only figurative. When you stop and think about it, it was, you know, it's that they, as I said earlier, they were connected. They came from Esau, of course, the Edomites. And so there's a connection there, but they're only brethren from a figurative standpoint. That's how the term is used in the context of Amos 1. But with the Israelites, we're talking about real brethren. We're talking about others who are a part of Israel. We're not even talking about Judah now. They were oppressing other Israelites, others who were a part of the northern kingdom. And so it's particularly grievous, their sins against them. It says in verse 6 and 7, first part of verse 7, thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not revoke the punishment, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Those who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and turn aside the way of the afflicted. Remember, they're talking about their own with regard to that. Because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Some have charged this, instead of saying it the sin of injustice, they just call it covetousness. Because a lot of their crime, a lot of their acts were done because they were greedy, wanting more land. The rich opposing the poor, oppressing the poor rather. And that's what a lot of this was, but it was it had to do with sometimes individuals would find themselves in debt. And in those days, if you owed, a debt, if you couldn't pay it, you could be sold into slavery. And so that was going on. But there were different laws and different contingencies that God put in place to protect the poor and so on. But they were ignoring that. They were, again, they're selling the righteous. The righteous would be those who were right with God, which would tell you they were good people, God-fearing people, trying to keep the law, people who God was pleased with. And what that tells you is, okay, they got themselves in debt. But what do you expect from a good, God-fearing people, a person who happens to be in debt? What are they going to do? They're going to pay it back. Just give them a chance. They're going to pay it back. But they were just going overboard. They were belligerent. And when someone just owed just a little something, they were selling the needy for a pair of shoes. Like, that's, in other words, not to receive a pair of shoes, but that's the price that they owed. And we have record of Israel actually acting in that kind of way. If you look at Second Kings, you'll remember the story, I'm sure, of the widow whose husband died. It's really a sad story, but it turns out great. It's in the days of Elisha. And look at this in 2 Kings chapter 4. And we'll not read, you're tempted to read the whole story because it starts off sad and it ends up in a glorious fashion because Elijah performs a miracle and rescues this widow and her sons. But the way it starts is very sad. The wife of one of the sons of the prophets cried to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead." So you have a woman, she has a good life, she has a nice family, a good husband, children, and her husband dies. That happens, doesn't it? We're all too familiar with that. And it's always a very sad thing. And we have compassion upon those that lose a spouse. And we particularly do, we do with anybody. But of course, if it hits closer to home, if someone here at Brown Street loses a spouse, then we really have compassion and sympathy because we have a relationship with each other. And so here, this woman is in this kind of situation. You notice she says, your servant, my husband is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord. So he was a good man. They had a good relationship. He was a God-fearing man. But he died. And then it goes on to say, but the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves. Like, really? You lost her. She just lost her husband. And the first, so now she's in a little bit of debt. The husband, probably the money maker, and he's dead. Now she's in a little bit of debt. And the first thing the creditor wants to do is come and take her sons. That's extreme. That's uncalled for. It's like if you had a credit card debt, and you know people are thousands of dollars in debt credit cards, right? Let's say you owed $50 on a credit card. Next thing you know, in the middle of the night, they're coming to repossess your car. What are you going to think? Really? $50. That's not right. That's extreme, isn't it? That's what's going on here. When someone owed a poor person, owed a little nothing, the rich would come along and just take desperate, just extreme measures against them. That was their way of oppressing the poor. You notice it says those who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and turn aside the way of the afflicted. They were just cruel to those who were afflicted. That basically is figurative language that simply means in our own language, they were treating the poor like dirt. The people of God, their brethren, They just treated them like dirt because they could. And so one commentary says that his commentary on this is supported by corrupt judges, which most commentaries believe that's what was going on here. There were judges taking bribes for just a little bit, and turning the innocence of a person into guilt just for a little bit. And so the support is supported for corrupt judges. The rich were suing the poor who couldn't pay their bills and forcing them into servitude in slavery. So it sounds a lot like we're right back dealing with the nations, but we're not. We're dealing with the people of God. And it's just a sad situation. One of the things we need to take from this, God is condemning them for that because God cares about the poor. And if God cares about the poor, how should we feel about the poor? We should have the same attitude. And over and over we read, let's read some of these passages. We'll not read all of them, but turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 15. Deuteronomy chapter 15, and he gives a verse 7 beginning. This is just an example. Again, we'll not read all of these passages, just a few of them. Deuteronomy 15 at verse 7 says, if among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother. But you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart. And you say, the seventh year, the year of release is near, and your eye looks grudgingly on your poor brother, and you give him nothing. And he cried to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. He's talking here about the Jubilee, when servants were all released. And, you know, you just harden your heart. Well, yeah, this fellow's poor. He's going to be released in a couple of years anyway. So no need. And harden your heart. And don't help. Don't lend when you can. And there's just passage after passage. All of these passages speak to that. Look at Psalms 14. Psalms 41 rather. But Proverbs 14 is a good one too to mark down. But Psalms 41 and at verse 1, the psalmist says, this is David, blessed is the one who considers the poor. Blessed is the one who considers the poor. In the day of trouble, the Lord delivers him. And just mark that down. Get out your reference and look at a concordance and look at how many times God has something to say about the poor, how we should treat them, and how he will treat us and bless us if we have the right attitude towards them. Oh, that's just Old Testament stuff. Yeah, look over at, you know this passage, look over at 1 Timothy chapter 6 and what Paul says to Timothy about the rich. In 1 Timothy 6 and at verse 17, he says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good. Who? The rich. And of course, that's relevant, isn't it? Who's rich among us? We're all rich. It really depends. You may not be rich in this country, the standard of this country, but in the world, you're rich. And so what Paul says here is certainly applicable to us. Do good, he says. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. And so the point in all of this, don't think that this is just a side issue that isn't really all that important. As God is setting forth an oracle against Israel, the very first thing he deals with is injustice, and particularly in the form of oppressing the poor. And so it's a serious matter. And then he condemns them for immorality. And it's just really shocking the depths to which Israel fell. In Amos 2:7b, the second part of verse 7, a man and his father go into the same girl, so that my holy name is profaned. Now, we don't know exactly what he's talking about. We have some idea, but it could be a couple of different things. But you could just read that right there and know none of it's good. Like, there is no good twist on this. But he probably is condemning an act of idolatry. But that just shows you how far they had fallen. Like, they would go into these houses of prostitutes, shrines of prostitutes that would sometimes house hundreds of prostitutes. And that was an act of idolatry. One way that idolatry took place, but again, this is the people of God. We're not dealing with the nations anymore. We're talking about Israel. So they had this practice that was going on. James Coffin, in his commentary, just put it like this. The damsel, which is the girl under consideration, meant is one of the prostitutes attached to the idol of Astarte, temple. That is a Canaanite god that's equivalent to the Greek Aphrodite. And so, but that's the temple. So they had these temples and the prostitute being a part of her filthy worship. The Canaanite religion thought that the performance of the human action of procreation could be used to remind the god to fertilize the earth. It is this practice which Amos sees and denounces in Israel. The holy Yahweh is being worshipped as a Canaanite Baal. And so that could very be. It's probable that that's what Amos is dealing with. And it's just a shame. This is one of the reasons, you remember in the very beginning, what did God tell Israel when the Jews were going into the land? What was their first order of business? Do it. Right. Drive them out. Destroy all the heathen, the Canaanites, the Ammonites, all of these people, get rid of them. They have to go. Why? Because they're going to influence you for evil. They failed to do that. Now we see they're being influenced for evil. Like, these are shrines that belong to these heathens. And now we're learning that some of the Israelites who are supposed to be servants of Yahweh and who are supposed to be honoring him and observing his law, that's what they're doing, going to shrines. Like, just think about how wicked this is. Hey, son, let's spend some time together. Okay, Dad, what do you want to do? Well, let's go to the shrine of prostitutes over there. Is that an example for a father to set for his son? I mean, it's just as bad as it sounds. It's terrible. And that's the least of what it could be talking about. There are some who believe that the girl could have been a household slave. Now, I mean, I don't care how you look at this. It's sinful, wrong, and abomination to God. But this is even worse. So they have a household slave. And both the father and the son are committing sexual immorality with a household slave. Could be a situation where the slave was purchased for the son. And now both of them are committed for the Father, it would be, of course, in both scenarios, it would be adultery. The seventh law of the Ten Commandments. So he was guilty of that, the very least. There, a lot of Jews believe that this would be considered under the law of Moses would even be considered as incest. And so, it was just a wicked thing. Another commentary and showing this point of view says the girl may have been a female slave purchased by the father either for himself or for his son. For both to have sexual relations with her in either case would represent a breach of covenant. It would violate the law. He gives the passage. If you turn over, look over at Exodus chapter 21 just quickly. There are many passages in the first five books that deal with this sort of behavior. But here's in Exodus chapter 21. And let's see how much of this. May not read the whole thing, but beginning at verse 7, Exodus 21 at verse 7, it says, "Now when a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food or clothing or martial rights." And you can read, this is what you need to understand. The Old Testament is tough. As Christians, as we read some of these things, you have to remember this about the Old Testament. A lot of laws that were set forth are what we call contingency law. And it was God putting laws in place, not because he approved of the behavior, but as protection almost always for women. Like, that's even why the divorce. You remember why Moses said that they were to give a writing of divorcement to somebody? What was the purpose of it? There was a different. Why did he say to do it? Because of what? Because of the hardness of your heart. Like, God didn't change his view, one man, one woman for life. But God knew that unholy men were going to act in certain ways, violate his law, and so to protect the women, he put contingency laws in place. And that explains a lot of tough passages that deal with why did God allow that? Of course, then we remember Acts chapter 17. At the time of ignorance, what? God winked at. But now what? He commandeth repentance. And so don't think, okay, well, maybe we can get away. No, we'll go down that road. But the point of it is, these Israelites were so bad, not only were they not behaving morally the way God would want them to in the very beginning, they were even violating the contingency laws. Like, they just would not do what God wanted them to do. And you see this last part here, so that my holy name is profaned. Again, there's not a few scholars. Maybe in reading this passage and looking at what scholars say about it, it may be, I don't know for sure, I didn't take account, but it may be the majority of scholars who believe that what this means, the Hebrew language indicates, that they were doing this to purposely profane the name of God. Now, that's not my first take. When I read that, at least in our English Bible, it's not the first thing I think of, but I have to bow down. I'm not a Hebrew scholar. And when they say that's what the Hebrew means, possibly it does. One way or the other, what we need to understand, when we as people of God violate his moral laws, we profane his name. Whether we're doing it on purpose, doing it so that his name will be profaned, I wouldn't accuse us of that. It doesn't matter if you're doing it for that purpose or not. That's the end result of not living by the Word of God. I always think about Romans chapter 2. And you know the passage. I've used it. I just recently wrote about it in a blog. If you read the blog, in Romans chapter 2, this passage so much reminds me of people of God today, of all of us today, of what has happened over and over. I'm not saying those of us who are here, but through the years, over and over, we could say the same thing that Paul says about the Jews of old, about those who have been members of the church. Verse 17, begin Romans chapter 2, and at verse 17, but if you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast in God and know his will and approve what is excellent because you are instructed from the law, and if you are sure that you yourselves are a guide to the blind and the light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourselves? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? Like, you think we see any of that in the church today? Individuals preaching one thing and then acting contrary to what it is that they're preaching? What do we always say about preaching? You have to do what? Practice what you preach. The Jews weren't doing that. The Jews were failing miserably in that. And when you go on to read this, it indicates here. Look at verse 15. Let's see. Past that point. Verse 24. For as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Interestingly, the Jews again, God's covenant people, they were doing, now we see this in our text, they were doing some of the same things that the Gentiles were doing. They claimed to be a light. They claimed to be teachers and instructors and know the law and live by the law. But they were doing some of the same things. And the Gentiles were blaspheming the name of God because of it. And that's what Amos, at the very least, is saying to these Israelites. That God's name is profane. Maybe they were doing it on purpose. But at the very least, his name is profane because of that. Leviticus chapter 22 tells us, verse 31, so you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord, and you shall not profane my holy name, that I may be sanctified among the people of Israel. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. So God indicates, God knows, if you don't keep my commandments, my name is going to be profane. You think because we're in a different dispensation under a different law that that now changes? Of course not. We claim to be Christians and we uphold the Word of God to people we work with and go to school with, people who know us and family members, whoever, who aren't Christians. And we claim to be teachers, members of the church, and they see us not living right. It's not just you they're going to talk badly about. They're going to profane, in some cases, the name of God. And that's what the Israelites were guilty of. Then they were guilty of heartlessness. And we see that in the first part of verse A. They lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in a pledge. So the law allowed individuals, if someone owed you something, you could take their outward garment as just as security for a loan, so to speak, is what it would be. But they had to return it at night. Because remember, we're talking in a lot of cases the poor. And so the garment would be a covering during the day, but it would be a blanket at night. So you could take that as a pledge, but you had to give it back at night. You could take it again in the morning, so they would be reminded what they owe, because during the day they wouldn't have that outer garment, but by night you had to give it back. That was the law. Here again, James Smith, in referring to it, the sinners in Israel would stretch out beside every altar upon the garments taken in pledge. Amos refers to the sacrificial feast held in the shrines at Dan and Bethel. The garments mentioned here were the large outer garments which formed the poor man's dress by day and cover by night. The law required that if these garments were pawned, they were to be returned by nightfall. And he gives you can read that passage for yourself, Exodus 22, verse 26. It talks about that very thing. If you take a garment in pledge, you got to give it back by night. They weren't doing that. Instead, they were laying it beside the altar. And some of this, the different interpretations of exactly what they were doing. It's just really, he's painting a picture. Instead of giving the garments back, they were using it to lie down on by altars. Now, it could be, again, these altars, you remember they had one in Dan and Bethel, and they were corrupt, of course. Where were they supposed to have an altar and go to worship? In Jerusalem. So the Israelites, they were way off base. Ever since the dividing of the kingdom, they weren't worshiping God the way they should, but they claimed to be. But they would have the nerve to claim they were serving Yahweh, even at these profane altars, but they would take garments that they were supposed to give back to the poor that they took for the, and they would lay them down. Now, what they would do with that is again debatable. Many scholars believe that he is referring to, again, sexual immorality that they would do beside the altars. And it's just painting a terrible, immoral picture of Israel. You wonder why this whole book now turns to a judgment and warning against Israel, because this is what they were doing. This is how they were behaving. Just every bit as bad as the nations we finished covering. So we'll finish one more, the last sin there next week, and then look at what he's going to do is he's going to put the mercy of God side by side these examples to show you the contrast between God and them. So we'll look at that next week. Appreciate your attention.